supposed to introduce the speaker and be real brief. I had never met this fella until tonight, but I knew him by reputation. We worked for the same outfit, and they say he is a real good speaker. And without further ado, may I present to you Mr. Jack S.
Thank you, George. You must have them steps there for them old people that's going to talk here. You know? Not you, Albert, I didn't. I'm very glad to be here. My name is Jack Sullivan. I am an alcoholic. I come from Louisville, Kentucky. My sobriety date is the 21st day of August of 1962. And my home group is the South Louisville Group of Alcoholics Anonymous that meets on Wednesday night in the city of Louisville. It's an open speaker meeting. It's the best AA group in the country. And if you believe that, there's something wrong with your group. But if you don't believe your group's the best, stay there and straighten it out. Don't go somewhere else and screw up another one. And I'm very, very glad to be here. It's sort of an up and down meeting for me. I've met a lot of y'all before, and so many of you have graciously told me you drove up because you knew I was going to be here. We've been friends over the years at certain places, and I think it really makes anybody feel good to know that. I think it's the nicest compliment in the world to a speaker when somebody comes in and said, "I came and knew you were going to talk." You know, I'd like to thank you for that because, it is a good feeling. I'm not an official speaker. The conference officially opens tomorrow. I was told that. So, I'm an unofficial speaker. And tonight is free, and that kind of hurts. I mean, you got to pay to hear Albert and Joe and Sally. Why the hell did you get in here for nothing? But I guess it can't be helped. It just worked out that way. It's a great fellowship and a great program, and it's been everything in my life. I have my wife with me. Some of y'all have met Gay many times. Gay is a member of the Al-Anon family groups. She's been a member of Al-Anon for over 28 years. She doesn't speak at these podiums. It makes her very nervous, and that's okay. I've never met anybody better one-on-one in Al-Anon than she is. And she was assigned to come to Al-Anon by my sponsor. Back then, those sponsors assigned everything. You know, and I'll never forget the night I told Hillary Sanders, who was my sponsor, that I was very serious about a lady. And he said, "Bring her up here." And I said, "Why in the hell would I want to bring her up here?" And he said, "Because I told you to." Well, that made sense to me. As anything they did back then made sense. So I brought her up to meet Hillary. And Hillary cased her and called Charlie and Mary Louise and says, "You take her to Al-Anon. If she's going to marry him, then they're going to Al-Anon and AA because that'll make their family life better." And he didn't lie because she'd been going for 28 years to Al-Anon, and I've been going to AA for a little over 29 years, and our family life's great. We've had our ups and downs, but nothing we can't solve and realize that, you know, we can be disagreeable today or disagree without being disagreeable. And I'd like for you to meet her, those of you who don't know her, so you will before we leave. Gay, would you stand up so they know who you are? And I get along real well with Al-Anon, some of them. You know, alcoholics amaze me. I love sometimes you hear somebody talking about a keen alcoholic mind. Do you ever hear somebody say that somewhere? You know, the only person ever said it's an alcoholic. You know, nobody else ever said it, you know. I mean, do you ever hear a guy say, "Here comes Joel with the keen alcoholic mind"? You know, they just don't say it. But they're supposed to be so damn smart and they believe anything you tell them. And, Jim Miller was up in Lexington here last year at our Al-Anon convention, and we go to all of them, and Tim was with him. And Tim and Jim walking around everywhere you went, saw one of them, you saw them all, and some guy said to me, he said, who is that fella with Jim Miller? I said, he's a psychiatrist. He said, a what? I said, a psychiatrist. He travels everywhere with Dr. Miller. I said, Jim is subject to depressive conniption fits. And I said, he really won't go anywhere without his doctor. You know? And don't you know half the people in Lexington, Kentucky think Tim's a psychiatrist? Huh? So it did something to enhance his character. But it was great, and Jim did good, and everybody up there loves him and Christy, and we've known him for quite some time, and it was a super Al-Anon conference. It really was. It's a lot of fun, and we taught that. We live in, you know, our lives are great. I'm not all that real serious about anything. I take my sobriety serious, but I enjoy living, and I guess it was because I was so fortunate when I came into AA that I ran with people that enjoyed life. You know, they had a lot of fun in living. It's not all that serious. When you take yourself all that serious, you're crazy, you know? And you don't have, I shouldn't say you don't have, you do whatever you have to do. But those were the type of people who sincerely believed, you know, that once you were capable of surrendering to the fact of who and what you were and became willing to take the action that's necessary to keep your life on track, when you came to Alcoholics Anonymous and did the things that you're supposed to do, not only in regards to your own life, but your willingness to help other people, that, you know, your life just had to get better. And it just had to get better. And mine certainly has, and I know Gay's has it, in Al-Anon. I get along real well with Al-Anons. Some of them I don't, but they say nasty things at times to alcoholics. They have been known to do that. I was sitting at a table one night, and a lady, some of y'all know her name, she'll remain nameless, but it's Sue Drum if you want her initials. And somebody at that table got to talking about reincarnation, and they said to me, do you believe in reincarnation? And I said, I don't know. And some guy said, if you believe in reincarnation and you could be reincarnated and you had to come back as an animal, what kind of an animal would you like to come back as? And I said, well, I'm from Kentucky, and, you know, our thoroughbred racehorse is famous up there, and I guess I like to come back as a horse. And Sue looked across the table, and she said, well, maybe next time you'll get lucky and come back to the front end. We had an Al-Anon lady up in Louisville that her husband drank. This is a true story. And I know it's true because an alcoholic told me. And they won't lie, and especially this guy. His name's Billy, and my wife don't believe his story, but Billy won't lie. You know, Billy told me one time, been sober a long time, maybe 35 years now. Billy told me one time, after you get sober for 25 years, AA's got a new book out. And after 25 years sobriety, you're allowed 3 resentments and 7 lies a year. And he says, I've never used any of mine. So I know he wouldn't lie. But he told me about a lady that her husband drank all the time, and he would not quit drinking. As hard as she tried, he wouldn't quit drinking. And he finally died. And when he died, she had him cremated, and she rolled his ashes with some marijuana and smoked him. And she, everywhere she went, she said that's the first time in 25 years that sucker ever made her feel good. And that's a true story. I swear. Because Billy told me and he wouldn't lie. I'm 62 years old, and that's old. You know, I love what my old friend Wino Joe used to say. Joe used to say, been around A a long time. He said, you can look at me and tell I've been somewhere for a long time. And I'm about the same way. And I was 33 years old when I came in Alcoholics Anonymous in 1962. And I was the youngest member of AA in the city of Louisville. We have a metropolitan population up there of about 1 million people. And nobody came to AA at the age of 33. And them old fools that were there at that time, they didn't want you there either. You know, they look at you as much to say, what are you doing here? You know, you've got further to go. You know, you're too young to be here. And they really believe that. You know, it's not, I mean, they really believe that. I had a dear friend, some of y'all may have known him, and name was Paul Keebler. And Paul was sober 45 years when he died, I believe, or 44. And Paul said when he came into AA, they had a measuring stick. If you had 9 teeth, a wristwatch, and could count up to 10, he wouldn't let you in. That you really had more drinking to do, you lost a couple more teeth or your watch, you know. And for some reason, that phenomenon persisted among those people. You know, what are you doing here? You know. And it was a strange, strange deal with those cats. But I got there at that age, and I stayed. You know, I stayed. And there are some people who come to Alcoholics Anonymous who never drink again. And I never attached a lot of importance to that, but somebody was telling me not long ago, they said, you know, it is important because so many people slip, and you don't have to do it that way. Nothing wrong with it if you do and live, you know, but you don't really have to do it that way. I never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous when I came here. 1962, what age? 27 years old. And I'd never heard of it. There was not a lot of publication about it or anything. And it pretty much of a hidden program, I guess, in a way. Because there wasn't anybody that treated it. There weren't any doctors that handled it. Once in a while you'd get a hold of a psychiatrist who would take a look at it. And they never treated alcoholism as being a primary sickness back then. It was a secondary sickness. A symptom of something else. You know, and I only tell you this because now you can look at our society today, how far it's come. And it came this far through the dedication of a lot of people who got sick and tired over the years of the alcoholic being treated in a way that kind of bled him of his dignity. And he had a right not to be mistreated anymore. And I don't say that in a negative fashion for anybody that did it. The minister, the MD, the psychiatrist, psychologist, whatever. You know, I think they did what they thought was right. But it did not help alcoholics, and a lot of alcoholics died because of that. But you never really heard many publications about it. And so I'd never heard of it when I got here, and probably should have heard of it a long time ago. I wound up on Skid Row in the city of Louisville. I used to tell people I was a wino on the city streets of Louisville, but I believe it was Paul that told me, don't tell people that. There's no such thing in AA as winos. There are a lot of alcoholics that ran out of money. So I was an alcoholic that ran out of money living on Skid Row in Louisville, Kentucky. And at the age of 31 and a half, I was on Skid Row. I started out pretty good. I came from a good family. My father was the assistant director of personnel on the L&N Railroad Yard. And George is an old L&N engineer. And he heard I was on his trail and quit drinking. Then I was with a couple of guys up in Cartersville, Georgia last night, and they told me George drove them to drink, but I don't believe that. That one guy would have been hard to drive, wouldn't he, George? But anyway, my father was the assistant director of personnel on that railroad, and I eventually went to work for him when I was about 20 years old. I have an older brother who's 14 months older than I am, and he's an executive with the General Motors Corporation. Many years ago, through the influence of the general manager of the railroad and the friendship of my father, he was able to get free education, which was unusual back then, to the General Motor Tech Institute in Flint, Michigan. And he offered my father his friendship to talk with those people to get my brother and I in school up there. And my brother took advantage of it and went to school and got a degree in industrial engineering and is an executive with General Motors today. And he's been with them ever since. And I have two sisters who were younger than I, and they both married young and still have the same husbands, and they had about 4 children. So they were, you know, they were normal people. I'm not sure whether I come from a dysfunctional home or not. I asked my friend one time, some of y'all know Brian B. I said to Brian, do you think I came from a dysfunctional home? And Brian said, was you in it? And I said, of course I was in it. He said, case closed. You know? So you came from a dysfunctional home, you's in it. And my mother died when I was about 18 years old, so she's not a big part of my story. I don't really have a whole lot to tell you about my childhood. When I was, up to the time I was 16 years old, I don't really remember anything exciting. I did good in grade school, and I went on to high school, and when I was a sophomore in high school, my life began to change because I found other things out there in that world that nobody had ever taught me or told me about. When I got out to the corner at 4th and Central in Louisville, and if you've never been there, I hope you can come someday, but 4th and Central is a corner that borders Churchill Downs Racetrack. And Churchill Downs Racetrack is very famous. It's the home of the Kentucky Derby. A lot of people have been there, and for a lot of people that haven't have certainly seen it on television. So it's a very famous place, and that corner is really, really a nice place to be from. I still go by there every day and enjoy it. There's nothing wrong with the corner. There was something wrong with me. But a lot of things went on out there that nobody ever told me about at home. I got out there, and we didn't have a whole lot of money, just those very basic necessities of life. And I got out there, and I went to work in a filling station and got with a couple older guys who ran this place at night, and I got to hanging around with some guys that worked on that racetrack, and it was money to be made back then illegally. There was a lot of cheating went on. There wasn't film patrols and all those kind of things like you have today. So they could do a lot of things, and they did them, and you could actually make some money. And as a young kid, about 16 years old, now I got money, you know. And World War II was just about over at that time, and everything was rationed, and that gasoline was rationed, and you could get a hold of a lot of those ration coupons from people, and you'd have a lot of gasoline in those tanks that when people wanted the gas, that you didn't have to have the coupon. We could sell it to you. You couldn't buy a beer or whiskey, but the guys that owned those saloons down there, they brought the beer and the whiskey down so we could fill up their Cadillacs. And we'd fill up their Cadillacs, and they'd bring the beer and the whiskey, and we'd put it in a storeroom, and we'd drink it or sell it. A guy ran a couple of drug stores around here, and you couldn't buy cigarettes. And they had the good ones, the Luckies, the Camels, and the Chesterfields, but they didn't have any gasoline. So they'd bring the cigarettes and their Cadillacs over, and we'd fill them up and keep the cigarettes, put them in a storeroom, either smoke them or sell them. There was a few girls around there that didn't have any gasoline. You'll kind of have to draw your own conclusions about that, but I was off and running. And I don't know why. Now, why that lifestyle is attractive to some people, I don't know. I have heard it explained. I have seen books that thick. You could fill psychiatric libraries with reasoning behind why kids are that way or why some of you are still that way. Yeah. I don't know. What's the difference between me and my brother? I have no idea. Myself and my two sisters, I have no idea. That type of lifestyle and living where you had money in your pocket, drank booze, and had sex was the greatest thing I had ever discovered in my life. And it beat the hell out of Latin and algebra. You know? And I didn't want to go to school. I didn't care anything about school anymore, and I was a good student. A good student. I just didn't care anything about school. All I cared about was that lifestyle. And boy, my father and I went round and around over my drinking habits, the people I was with and the places I went. And I misread my father. I think everybody misreads their parents, you know, in our day and time. And I could never put with what my father was doing to me as anything else instead of doing what he was doing for me. I never saw that the discipline my father wanted me to have in my life was because he loved me and didn't want to see me hurt. I didn't have that much sense. That's why he did it, and I rebelled at that. So I argued with my father. I didn't like my father, and we did not get along well at all. And he didn't like what I was doing, who I was with, and where I was going. And they didn't have any child abuse centers then. He'd knock the hell out of you when he. So they didn't have any parent abuse centers then, you know. It was just a different world. You either did what he said or got out. You know, he wasn't a hard man to diagnose. My house, my rules. If you don't like it, get your own damn house, you know, and set up your own rules. And so we went round and round. And I'm eternally grateful, and sometimes I forget to say this, so I'll do it now, that my father lived for 8 years of my sobriety. My father and I were the best of friends. We used to sit down and talk and talk about my drinking, talk about my behavior, you know, and all he ever said was, you know, I'm glad it's over and I'm glad you're where you are. I said, how long was I sober where you didn't worry about me anymore? He said, a couple of years. And that's only natural, you know, but God, we were good friends. And could talk about anything. And I loved my father dearly, and he loved me, and I knew it. And when he died and he had cancer and things were not real good for him for quite a while, you know, when all the pieces of the death puzzle have to come together, he sent for me. You know, he wanted me to coordinate the puzzle. And he knew that I'd be there for my stepmother and the rest of whatever, and that things would be done right and done with a sense of responsibility and dedication. And you know, I'm sure you know, I don't have to tell you how much that really, really means to somebody. When all of your life you're just useless, undependable, and irresponsible to everybody that crosses your path. You know, and my father and I just, it was just so great. And my old sponsor and my dad, they were the best of friends, you know. And they had a great rapport, and it was a great life after I got here compared to what it was. But I never liked my father because of the way he tried to stop me. And I never had a lot of respect for my dad. I finally finished high school in a vocational school, and then I got out that corner, man, I went hog wild. And I just really got into it full time then, the best you can. And he'd say something, and I'd tell him to go to hell, and that's how he feel. Now, the only thing that changed my opinion of my father was the jail cell. You know. But what the hell, a jail changes your opinion of a lot of people. You know? I've often said the breeding ground of humility is the backseat of a squad car. You know? I mean, it breeds humility in alcoholics. You can go out here tonight at a bar and listen to some guy there drunk and talking about that old bitch he lives with. Lock him up. He'll put a quarter in that phone and she'll answer and he'll say, honey. You know? Now, she went from an old bitch to honey because of a jail. You know? It's just our nature. You know? Just our nature. It changed my opinion of my father. Little did I know, my father was too strong for me. My father was in Al-Anon and didn't know it. Yeah. And I mean, my dad believed if you dance to the music, you pay the fiddler. I ain't paying. My father believed if you're looking for a helping hand, it's on the end of your own arm. And he said, the only regret I have in life is that neither one of us knew where to put your hand. Until AA. Until AA. And if you're looking for a helping hand, trust me, it's on the end of your own arm. And get on your knees and thank God that however age you are, that you're alive and with your right mind, you found a place to put it. And that I didn't know and he didn't know. But he wasn't about to dance to the music I set up on. And I learned that the hard way. I'm 20 years old and in jail. I drop a dime in the phone, and he answers, and I said, Daddy. He said, what do you want? I said, I'm in jail. He said, why in the hell did you call me? I said, well, I thought you'd come down here and get me out. Oh, he said, as smart as you are. Why, he said, if I was you, I wouldn't worry about that. He said, I'm sure if you figured a way to get in, you'll figure a way to get out. And he hung up. And when I got out, he said, I've never been in jail. I understand they allow you one phone call. If I was you, I wouldn't waste it. I never called him again. Sort of a waste of time. I went to work for that railroad when I was 20 in their shops up home, and I stayed there for about 11 years. I think it was 61 when the bottom dropped out of everything. I progressively got worse as I went along, and I don't have to tell you all about that. You know all about it. You know? I just didn't care. Nothing mattered to me but that lifestyle. I'll give you one example. One time I got on my good behavior. And my father and I were on pretty good terms. My two sisters were speaking to me. The people I worked for and with thought, boy, what a change has come over this guy. And I was afraid and desperate like we get, you know. And one day, I went by My father asked me to go up to the hardware store and get a spring for a screen door. And I went by a saloon I used to drink in. And the guy said, let's go up to Lexington, go to the races at Keeneland. And I said, oh, I don't know. Oh, he said, come on, hell, we'll have a good time. Come on in here, let's talk about it. I went in. He said, let's have a beer. I said, well, you know, I ain't been drinking nothing for the last 3 or 4 months. Well, I know, but hell, don't do like you always did. Let's drink a couple of beers. We'll go to the races and have a good time and come back home. I said, well, you know, there's really nothing wrong with that. I got back 11 days later. You know, I had a job on the railroad. I had a home again with my father and a sister. Everything was going my way. But that didn't matter when we went to Lexington and had about 4 beers and run into a couple of women that lived in Paris, Kentucky, and didn't want us to go home. And the only thing that mattered to me was them 2 women, that beer, them race horses into hell with the railroad and my father and the connections with everybody. You know, and that's the way I was. And I wondered for years why I was that way. And an old friend of mine in AA, I was sitting one night, I'd been sober 25 years, and I listened to him talk, and he said, you know, at that time, it just seemed like the thing to do.
Yeah.
And I said, that explains it. You don't have to be a mental heavyweight to figure that out. It just seemed like the thing to do. And that was the story of my life. It just seemed like the thing to do. And I drank my way away from that railroad, and I became very bitter and resentful and hateful to God and all people. I never believed in God to begin with. Just never had any feelings for that kind of thing. I never had any feelings for religion, organized religion, or anything spiritual. I never really had I think as our book talks about, a close kinship with God and man. And that's what makes us different today. I do have that today, and I never had that close kinship with people or with God. I just had no feelings for it. It was just something that had really played no big part in my life. And I never married until I got in to AA. I never had any wife. I feel inferior a lot of times talking with some of you people, but, you know, I mean, that's awful to be riding in a car somewhere and listening to them 6 wives, and, you know, some people got 6 wives and 9 kids, and some people got 9 kids and no wives, and, you know, and I don't have any wives or any kids, and I never married, never had any desire to get married. It just was not in that, not the thing to do with the people I was with. Very few of them were married. They were gamblers and hustlers, and it just wasn't the thing to do. And I never came close to getting married. But I've never regretted that, because I've often said I'm the luckiest alcoholic in the world, because I remain single and childless, and I went to live in a gutter. And I think it's the neatest thing in the world to be single and childless and leave a home and go live in a street gutter. And it's a lot easier on a human being than it is some of you people who are, many, many of my friends, who I have seen you go out and get a gutter and take it home with you. And that filthy, stinking gutter runs right down through the middle of your own living room. And it's present in some of the finest homes in the country. And alcoholics, in their sick minds, honestly to God, believing that somebody else is responsible for what they've become. And they reach out of their living room gutters, and they drag beautiful women and children. And a lot of times you kids drag your parents through all of that stinking emotional garbage, you know, that literally destroys you and them. And it's so painful and so lonely and so desperate right in your own living room. And that's not present out there on the street. A guy like me, I had it made. It was the greatest thing in the world. But I became very bitter about it. You know, I became bitter at life and bitter at people. And I think the thing about that is I never became more aware of this than after I got that job with the railroad. I'll tell you about in a minute or two. And I will tell you, because I'm not going to allow Raffles to take up my time. Sometimes people go out in the hall and say, God, that guy was windy. You know, and you think, God, they raffled off everything but the balloons. You know, but it's neither here nor there. Neither here nor there. But I think what became really apparent to me on that job with the railroad was dealing with executives that worked for us that were chronic alcoholics that drank out of a desk drawer. and they were bitter and as angry as I was. And they could not understand why they were no longer welcome in the inner circles of those executive parties and things that went on. You know, they no longer felt like a part of that, and it became apparent to me then that even when people like us are sober, everybody's scared to death of us. They're afraid to invite us anywhere sober because we absolutely have no guarantees as to how we're liable to behave. You know, they can bring a guy like me to a party that ain't had a drink for 6 months, and I'm there for an hour and a half, and I want to whip the hostess, puke on his carpet, you know, try to take his old lady to bed, you know, and then I think he don't like me. Yeah. And I'm sitting around running around wondering why. You know, why don't they want anything to do with me when I'm sober? Now, you know that feeling of uselessness and bitterness came out of those executives as much as it came out of me at 4th and Central. I was no longer invited to where I used to go, and neither were they. And so I was madder than hell sober. You know, madder than hell sober. And the only thing that seemed to put me in a frame of mind where I didn't care, it was a drink. Yeah. And it was a fascinating thing of how a drink can make us where we just don't care. We become the rejector instead of the rejectee, you know. Charlie's having a party. I don't give a damn. I wouldn't have gone if he'd asked me. It's fascinating. And I became bitter and lonely in that alley. You know, and I lived in an alley with about 12, 14 guys. There was a hardware store there, and they used to throw those cardboard boxes out behind that hardware store, and that's what we slept in. Yeah. And it's a very, very, very lonely place to be. And you expect to die there, because everybody in the world has tried to scare you into not getting worse. You know, back then, that's all it was a fear game. How do you scare somebody scared to death? You know, how do you look at somebody that'll go bear hunting with a switch and give the switch to the bear? You know, but yet he's afraid of life. More afraid of living than dying. You know, and everything seems like, as the book says, it's just impending doom that has you engulfed in it. You know? And it's a terrifying, terrifying thing. The book calls it four horsemen, and they certainly are. They certainly are, and visited by them many, many times. And the cop said, if you don't quit drinking, you're going to go to jail. The judge says prison. The doctor said, if you don't quit drinking, you're going to die. The preacher said, if you don't quit drinking, you're going to hell. The boss said, the unemployment line. The wife of divorce, the father of the streets. All of this is going to happen to you if you don't quit drinking, as if fear had something to do with our sickness. You know? And it plays a big part in our individual life, but it certainly plays no part in the corrective measures of our life. You know? I drink because I cannot not drink. I don't do well out there sober because I live in a world by myself. You know? I have faith in nothing but me, and that don't work. But you sure hell not going to scare me into quit drinking. Experts have tried to scare people into quit drinking. We had a lady up home tried it. Her husband never would quit. She went down one night at a costume shop and bought a devil suit. And put that suit on, and that old guy come home. She was hiding behind a hedge. And he come home drunk about 1 o'clock in the morning. And she leaped out behind that hedge at him. And she said, I've come to get you. And that old drunk looked at her and said, who are you? She said, I am the devil. He stuck his hand out. He said, I got to put her there. He said, I've been wanting to meet you ever since I married your sister. Didn't help a bit. I found some interesting people on Skid Row, especially policemen. I never cease to be amazed at policemen on Skid Row. They ride down alleys hunting winos, sleeping in boxes. People are getting raped, robbed, burglaries going on, you know, and they come up with them intelligent questions from the academies. You know, they'll throw a light in a cardboard box on a wino and ask him what he's doing. You say nothing, they arrest you. You know? I've often thought I wish I'd have known something about alcoholism when they threw a light on you and said, what are you doing? You could have stuck your head out of that box and said, officer, I'm progressing. I think it would have floored him a little bit. But. I borrowed some money from a finance company, and that guy couldn't find me for about a year. And, man, I'm telling you, they ain't friendly when they can't find you. I got $500 on a signature only and a jackpot deal with a guy on a railroad. The two telephone calls this loan officer made were to my friends. And I got it on signature only, man, and I didn't have 3 cents. Cost a quarter to go around the world. I couldn't have got out of sight. But I got that money, and I never paid him, of course. And he was hunting me, couldn't find me. And it blew his mind, man. And he'd been on my trail for a long time. And he finally, one of them bartenders around there squealed on me and said, go back there in that cardboard jungle, you'll find him. And he come back, got enough nerve, I guess, come back there one day. And I was sitting in one of them big old freezer boxes and had the flap closed. And it was raining, and a three-day-old racing farm and a pint of wine. And he come back there snooping around, and I could finally, you know, you could tell he didn't belong back there. He had a suit and a tie on. He finally got up enough nerve when he saw me in there that he walked over to where I was sitting, and he knocked on my box, and I opened the flap to let him in, and he said something I thought was the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard in my life. He asked me if I was Jack Sullivan. I said yes, and he said, I'm going to tell you something, boy. If you don't start making some payments on this loan, he said, you're going to be in a hell of a lot of trouble. And I don't know to this day what he had in mind, maybe tar and feather or something, right? First day of August, 1962, about 9:30 in the morning, and I remember the day and the time from hospital records. I was sitting in the back room of this saloon, and the guy that owned it let us in, and two or three of us, and we were sitting there in a booth with a bottle, and the back door of that saloon opened, and my father walked in with a guy I never saw before in my life. I hadn't seen my father in a long time. And all my teeth had been knocked out. I was suffering from malnutrition and dehydration, and I was yellow from hepatitis, and had long hair and a beard, and I was filthy, dirty, you know, and I was just a worthless-looking piece of human flesh, and I really didn't want my father to see me that way, although I would have professed to you if you'd have listened. Who gives a damn, you know, that macho crap, but I never was so ashamed in my life when my dad walked in there. And I had tried to establish a telephone conversation with him on a couple of occasions, and, you know, and I tried to plead on his sympathy about giving me some money to eat on, and he said evidently I enjoyed being hungry, I wouldn't work. That's the way he felt about it. And I don't blame him for it. I remember one time I told him I was sleeping outdoors and I was cold. And he said, evidently you're an outdoorsman. You won't work. Yeah. And I mean, just the kind of guy he was. And I could not believe he was there. And the guy was with him. I had no idea who he was. It was sort of a startling thing, as you can imagine. And my dad went over and sat on some stools that run around a lunch counter. And the guy was with him came over to where I was at a table. And he was a big, tall, distinguished-looking man. And he had on a suit and a tie. And he smiled and he stuck out his hand, wanted to shake hands with me. That was so unusual in my life. You know, nothing like that occurred in my life in 2.5 years. And he said, hi, my name is Jack. I understand so is yours. And I don't think I answered him. He said, I'm a friend of your father's, and I'm a friend of a man on the LN Railroad who was the vice president of labor relations, a man named Wilbur Shaw, who George knew. And Wilbur was very interested in alcoholism. And Wilbur had told Jack about me, and they got my dad up there, and my dad didn't want to really get involved, but Jack encouraged him that I deserved the opportunity to find out what was wrong with me. And through that process, they came. And he said, I'm a friend of your father's, and he said, I've come out here to help you. I hope you'll let me. He said, I can't help you if you won't let me, but I hope you'll let me. And I asked him the obvious why, you know. Why, stranger, would you care about me? Why would you take time from whatever it is you have to do to come to a place like this to see somebody like me? And he said something I didn't particularly believe at that time. It was true. It was the most profound statement I've ever heard in AA. I never expect to hear one more profound. Why would you care about me? And he smiled and he said, I used to be like you are. and somebody helped me. And that's why I came. I used to be like you are. And somebody helped me. And that's why I came. And I'm sure that everybody sitting in this room tonight will tell you the same thing. I'm sure that Albert and Sally and Joe and the rest of them that are going to speak here will tell you the same thing. I used to be like you are. And somebody helped me. And that's why I came. He said, please, come go with us. Your father has paid your medical insurance. I have a psychiatrist in the asylum up here who's willing to admit you. Let's see if we can't help you. And I got in their car and went. I'll never forget, I said to Jack, Jack Dawes was this guy's name, and Jack's dead now, but I said to Jack, do I have to go looking like this? And he smiled and said, do you have some place to change? But I went there, and I was admitted that morning at 10:30 in the morning, 21st August, 1962. That was the last drink that I was to ever take. And if you'd have told me that then, I knew you was crazy. But I got there, and in about a week, I got a little better, as we do. I became me all over again. You know, and I'd met a chick in there, young girl running around that nut house, and I thought she's real cute, and I fell in love with her, and I still think that's the most interesting thing I ever see is to find two drunks in love in a nut house. You know? Well, they don't call them asylums anymore. They call them treatment centers. You know, the big book talks about asylums, but today they're treatment centers. It really sounds good. Language changes for our benefit. You know, if somebody calls your house and they say, well, Mary's not here, we had to put her in the treatment center. You know, sounds better than saying, we took her to the asylum yesterday. It just sounds better, you know. Back years ago, we used to get a girl, take her somewhere and shack up. And now they get in meaningful relationships. You know? It just sounds better, you know. It's the same damn thing, it just sounds better. You know? But I was running around that damn hospital in love, and if you'd have set me on the side of a bed and put one sock on a foot, I wouldn't have known whether to lay down or get up. I mean, I was just that damn rum-dum, and I was in love, and you still see that today in those places. You ever see a couple run around them treatment centers, they're holding hands, and they blinking eyes at each other, and they can't wait till they get out of there. And a lot of times they don't. You know? The only thing I know that's dumber than that is somebody that works there that tries to separate them. Trust me when I tell you this. Trust me. If you work in one of those places, you got two drunks in love, leave them alone. In fact, do everything in your power to keep them together. Because if you get them separated, they'll screw up four people. They're just kind of meant for each other. Well, a nurse walked in the room, and she gave me that Al-Anon handshake. You've seen it. She said, don't you go anywhere tonight. We're going to the AA meeting. And I said, we're going where? She said, to the AA meeting. I said, what in the hell is an AA meeting? A meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Are you insinuating you think I'm an alcoholic? And she said, I'm not insinuating anything. I said, I'll have you know I'm no damn alcoholic. Now, you know, alcoholics are people that have problems they can't handle, right? Well, we don't fit in that category. A 16 or 17-year-old kid, 80-year-old man says, I ain't an alcoholic, that's why. Alcoholics are people that have problems they can't handle. And besides, there was a stigma to being an alcoholic back then. It wasn't popular as hell like it is now. You know? Now everybody wants to be an alcoholic. You know, and run to AA and tell the judge. And I mean, it's great. You know, here a while back, a lady slipped. Drank a quart of rubbing alcohol, wrote a book, and become a millionaire. I did that in 1961 and put me in jail. You know? It's just got better. You know? My old friend Wino Joe said it was a stigma to alcoholism. He didn't know what a stigma was, but he said he knew there was one. You know? Joe said he had two nephews. One of them was a Republican and the other one was a homosexual, and they thought more of them than they did him. That's a stigma. And I didn't want to be a stigma. So I said to that nurse, I ain't no damn alcoholic, and I ain't going to any AA meeting. She said, you ever think you could be wrong? Ain't that a hell of a thing to ask alcoholics? How many damn alcoholics have you ever met that were wrong? And if we were wrong, we'd never admit it. And we'd struggle like hell to prove we was right. You know? Paul told me one time about an old alcoholic cowboy out west, and he come out of a saloon one day, drunker than hell there in Texas, and an old man come in town riding on a mule, and the drunken cowboy come out of that saloon, and when that old man got off that mule, he went out there and asked him if he could dance. And that old man said, no. I said, I don't know anything about dancing. And that alcoholic cowboy said, I bet you can. And he got his six-shooter out and started shooting at that old man's feet, and that old man got to dancing. He was counting them bullets, and when that cowboy fired that sixth bullet, he reached up on the back of that mule and got a shotgun. Stuck in that alcoholic's face. He said, did you ever kiss a mule's ass? He said, no, but I've always wanted to. No, but I've always wanted to. But I said, I ain't wrong about that, and I ain't going to any AA meeting. She said, you'll be back there with me tonight, or I'll put you over there where the doorknob's on the outside. Now, if you've never been in one of them places, they have architectural defects in them. Some doors only have one knob. It ain't on your side. And I thought, well, I'll go. Sort of volunteering. And I went back to that AA meeting in a student nurse's classroom, 33-year-old man with a nurse holding my earlobe. And I got to the door and there stood an old woman, 60 years old, named Margaret Bivens, beautiful lady. And Margaret's passed away. God, she was a pretty lady. And she's standing there in that doorway. You couldn't get by her. Smiling, you know. And she put her arm around me and called me honey. And she said, hi, honey. Would you like a cup of coffee and a cookie? And I thought, wonder where in the hell she thinks I'm from, you know? A half a pint and a hooker. Right, yeah. Yeah. A cup of coffee and a cookie. And I thought, I've heard them stories about old women and young boys, you know. Well, I went on in and sat down, and some old guy got up talking like I am tonight. His name was Brownie Sayers, and I don't never want to forget those old guys. You know, and it's sad that a lot of you all will never get to meet them, and I'm sure that Albert could tell you that. They were class all by themselves. You know, they really were. They were something else. You know, and they were the way they were because all them drunks that came to them came, you know, they came in there drunk, man. You know, you didn't get them after a 30-day education. You know, they didn't know anything when they got there. And about half of them were defiant as hell, you know, and the other half were meek and humble, and they knew how to treat you, I guess. But that old guy got to talking, and I interrupted him. I made an ass out of myself, and they're going, shh, I'm going, you know. And I'm telling you, it's a mess. I made ass out of myself in there, you would not believe. And finally that meeting was over, and I went out that door, and there stood that damned old woman. And Margaret looked at me and smiled, and she said, honey, you come back next week now. I said, we need people like you. And I thought, they ought to put that old broad in a home somewhere, you know, get her off of the street. And I went back the following week, and I sat down next to an old man I had seen there the week before. His name was Hillary Sanders, and he was an old fool with a burr haircut and grouchy as hell. And I sat down there next to him, and he looked at me, and they called you boy. Everybody was a boy. You know, how you doing, boy? Yeah. And I thought, you know, that's really none of his business how I'm doing. I don't even know him, and he doesn't work here, but he's old. And I thought, why don't you be nice to old people? You know, and I really believe that today. Yeah. I said, I'm doing all right, old man, but I ain't no damn alcoholic. And he looked at me and he said, really? And I said, really? And he said, well, if you ever find out what you are, you ought to do something about it. You look like hell. And I got up and moved away from him. And I went to two more meetings in that hospital, and they transferred me to a place called Western State in Hopkinsville, Kentucky, which is another asylum. And back in 1962 had an alcohol ward on it where they would put all the alcoholics together, and a Lithuanian doctor down there who was very wise in the ways of alcoholics and alcoholism and tried to help them, and I spent 40 days there. You went there or went to jail? My father and this AA guy got a court order on me, and I went there or went to jail. And I'd been to jail, so I thought, well, you know, I go there, and I hated the damn place. That's, you know, I look back. I laugh tonight. Don't we have good fun laughing at ourselves? We all thought we were so damn smart. You know, that's why it's funny to be so damn dumb. You know, I lived for one solid year on Swiss cheese and crackers and beer. And I wasn't in that damn hospital 2 weeks, and I wrote a letter to my father complaining about the food. I thought he'd run down there and get me out, you know. Yeah, isn't that crazy? Bitching about what we had to eat. You know, hadn't eaten for a month. Yeah. But I stayed there 40 days, and those guys would try to help me. But I had not changed my attitude. And as you well know, and the book well tells you, you can't be helped until that takes place. You've got to change that. And so I came back to Louisville, and my father had already formed a conspiracy with Hillary Sanders and Jim Crichton and George Spencer and Leo Schoenbacher, and they're all dead, or I wouldn't be mentioning their names. AA's fun to me. I love it. I have real fun. I was talking somewhere the other night, and I said to I never mention anybody's name from this podium that's not dead. And one of my old friends is sitting there in the audience. He's about 85 years old, been sober 43 years. And I said, Mike England. And he looked up and he said, by God, I ain't dead. You know. And I said, hell, I didn't know that. I apologize, you know. But when I got back home, the phone rang, and my sister let me go live with her, and it was Hillary, you know. And he said, your father's going to bring you up to Lady of Peace Hospital tomorrow night. I'll meet you there. And hung up. Now, back then, where I come from, in 62, there was no such thing as a chip system, and just the way where I came from. It had nothing to do with where you came from. There was no such thing as a chip system where we're 9 1/2 shoes, you know, and you stayed sober with a shoe in your butt, you know. And the only thing you had to learn, you went to speaker meetings. You listened and you identified with those people. You were told three things that did not require a lot of intelligence. That was to sit down, shut up, and get in the car. Now, I used to wonder why they hollered, get in the car. And it dawned on me one day that the only time they said that was when they let you out the night before, and they said, I'll see you tomorrow night at 6:30, and drove off. Then asked you if you was going. I'll see you tomorrow night at 6:30, and drove off. And you think all day long, I ain't going up. I'm watching a ball game, you know. So they'd drive up, Hillary or Leo. And you'd step out on the porch and you'd say, I don't think, get in the car! Yeah. So that's all there was to it. Sit down, shut up, and get in the car. And it seemed like they always hollered, get in the car. And that was because of where they hollered it at, I guess. But you went with them. Their philosophy about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I guess it's mine, I think we tend to pass on what we were taught, you know, and anything like that is okay. You know, there's no such thing as a right and wrong way if you're sober, happy, you know? If you're happy and free and sober people and you enjoy life, what you learn the way you learned it has got to be okay because here you sit. See? But those were people who absolutely believed that you had nothing to say, and you went to speaker meetings, so you didn't have anything to say, until you surrendered to the fact of what you were. And they believe that the surrender process in Alcoholics Anonymous came through the first three steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. When you got honest and could see yourself for what you were, then you could begin the surrender process. Sanity was linked to that honesty. If you would come to AA long enough and stay sober, you would eventually come to an AA. That's what they're talking about. An awareness, let's say. But you would come to, and you would come to believe. And when you came to believe, that surrender process could start. When you got honest, you know, I don't think the first step was a problem, and I'm not going to go through all of them, so don't get nervous. The first step of a powerlessness over alcohol and an unmanageable life is the easiest thing in the world for any drunkard ever lived. Look at your own track record. Just look at your own track record. And if you want to, for now, if you're new, if you want to argue the point of whose fault it is, let's assume it is everybody else's fault. You've got absolutely nothing to do with it. Who gets hurt? Who's dying? Who gets beat up? Who goes to jail? Who's miserable as hell? Who can't live out there without it? See? So your powerlessness and your unmanageability speaks for itself. You've proven that. If you go to a racetrack, you buy a racing form. You know why? To look at the past performance of the horse. Your racing form of life, read it. Your past performance of life. You know, that's just a catch you want to play with yourself. And they didn't even fool with that, man. You know, the old cliche, if you're so damn smart, why are you here? You know, if you're so knowledgeable about everything, baby, how come you're walking? You know, how come you don't have any friends? How come you don't have any money? How come you don't have any respect? How come you don't have any dignity if you're so damn smart? Your track record speaks for itself. Blow right on by that one. You know, and by coming here and opening your mind and listening to these people, you're soon going to understand that if you want to be restored to sanity, it will determine on how honest you can get with yourself. Simple question. What do you see when you look in the mirror? Yeah. And the day will come after a while, because you're surrounded with what these people have. And let's face it, there ain't a human being that ever lived that don't want to be loved. There ain't a human being that ever lived that don't want to be wanted. There ain't a human being that ever lived that don't want to have some sort of interconnection to a spiritual being that seems to sustain them through the tragedies of life. There never lived a human being who don't want that. Yeah, and it goes beyond the nature of self-preservation not to want that. And you can identify as you listen to these people. And that's why, and I don't want to get on a tirade about that in Callaway Gardens, and I won't, but, you know, that's the secret to Alcoholics Anonymous. All of our knowledge and all that stuff's okay, but the new guy that walks in the door, you know what he identifies with? The problem. When he comes in off of the street, and it's our responsibility in Alcoholics Anonymous to see to it that he's able to identify with what he hears here. And all I'm saying to people in our society today, if what you think supersedes what AA says, then there's something wrong with all of us. We owe that to those people who walk in here and say, I can identify. Alcoholics Anonymous is not a biochemical or pharmaceutical industry. A drug is a drug is a drug. So what? What the hell's that got to do with AA? If you ain't drank enough alcohol to talk about it from here, then you don't belong in here. And that's all AA says. We owe it to our people who come in here to be able to identify with what we say. That's the backbone of Alcoholics Anonymous. AA says, you got other problems? Come on in. Hey, man, sit down here and have a cup of coffee and a donut. How you been? Be our friend. Enjoy our fellowship. When they say it's now time to start the meeting, we're here to discuss the problems that led alcohol took us to, so that guy can identify. And if you want to talk about something else, go somewhere where they talk about it. That's all AA's saying. You would have me committed to some damn insane asylum if I come down here tonight and start talking about Twinkie addiction. God, I went by the Kroger store today and Jesus. And when I got to them Danish pastries, oh my God. What the hell's the difference? What's that sick, puking drunk understand? You know, don't ever sell the identification of the problem short. We all get smart with our sobriety. We all come in here now, and that's not wrong. It only is with a hell of a lot more knowledge than we have awareness of the feelings of our heart. Alcoholics Anonymous is a language of the heart, primarily because we've experienced it. We speak from the way we feel, not from what we know. And if you don't believe that, find you a guy with 25 years sobriety that gets drunk. Find a guy that can quote the big book from end to end after 25 years of sobriety. Find a guy that was a state delegate to New York. Find a guy that helped more damn alcoholics than you can ever imagine. Find a guy who was the pillar of Alcoholics Anonymous and sober 27 years and got drunk. And he was my best friend. And he never got sober again. And when I asked him why, he looked at me and tears in his eyes, unbelievable for a 50 or 60 year old man to cry the way he did. He pointed his finger and stuck at my face and he said, "You listen to what I have to say. God knows I've tried. Do you understand me? God knows I tried. I cannot recapture the feelings I used to have for people, God, and myself." And he had all the knowledge you need. All the knowledge you need. And that's what those old guys believed in. You know? I remember sitting to Hillary one night, I said, "I can go along with this pretty good, you people. I never believed in God and don't propose to start." He said, "Who cares what you believe?" I said, "Don't God care?" He said, "He couldn't care less. I don't know if anybody in this room that gives a damn what you believe in." You see, what you believe in brought you here. What you believe in made you what you are. What are you? How do you answer those questions? You know, I knew what I was, and so did he. But he said the only important thing in Alcoholics Anonymous is what we believe in. "I believe you'll be okay if you stay here with us. I believe that God believes that too. Whatever you believe is not important. If you stay here with us, you will make the decision you want what we got. You will become willing to implement into action the things that are necessary to change your life. Because you cannot stay in here with us. You can't do it 365 days a year." And that's what we did. Not 90 and 90. I often wonder what them people do on the 91st day. Eh? Somebody tell me something. Yeah. Well, you can't be surrounded with these people without wanting what they have. You know? And he was so true. It was so true. I came to believe in God. You know? And I knew at that time God believed in me. I asked him one night, I said, "Do you have any idea what God's will is for me?" He said, "Yeah, exactly the opposite of your own." You know the way those old guys describe God's will for you? It's what happens next. I thought about that for a while. I ran an old friend of mine the other night, we were talking. I said, "You know, it's strange how things kind of get away from you after a while." You say, "What's God's will for me?" They said, "Whatever happens next." "How are you going to handle what happens next?" "Whatever it is, it'll be God's will for you if you're trying to do what's right. And how are you going to handle it?" And I did the best I could with it. And I went to, I got my job back with that railroad. I met Gay. We got married. And things began to fall in place for me. All because I went to meetings, I didn't drink, and I stuck with them guys who told me what to do. And I did what they told me. And I took the steps of AA. in order that I might speak the language of the heart. You cannot speak it without taking it. Yeah. And when it was, you know, a couple of years later down the road, it was great. And it's been a super life. You know, I'm not as serious, you know, and don't get me wrong, it's not saying right or wrong again, it's only me. You know, I don't do a lot with that. I wake up and smile. One of the finest men I ever met in my life always had a smile on his face, started Alcoholics Anonymous in Nashville, Tennessee, and I'm proud to say he was a friend of mine. And Jack always smiled. I saw him one day, we got talking about this, and Jack said, "You really into that? Every four step, every 6 months?" I said, "No, not really, those guys didn't do it." I said, "You know, I know what I'm doing right and wrong," and things like that, and Jack said, "Yeah, me too." He said, you know what I do every day? Let me tell you what I do every day. He said, back when I was drinking, I sit in my apartment house one night and a dog, I run out of liquor and I went down to the liquor store to get something on the way down and a dog bit me. And he said, I come back home and the neighbors called the police and the police come in and told me that I was going to have to take rabies shots. They couldn't find that dog. And he said, I wouldn't take them. And the cops told me I might have rabies. And he said, I'm sitting there drinking whiskey thinking, what am I going to do if I got rabies? So he said, I went in, I got me a tablet and a fountain pen, and I sit down at that table, and I wrote down the name of everybody I was going to bite. And he said, I thought in all fairness, I ought to write down the names of people who would want to bite me if they had rabies. And I filled up a couple of more pages. And he said, Jack, in my sobriety, and God knows, he said, you know it's been a happy And he said, I enjoy living. And I said, I know you do. He said, every day of my life, I get up and get my coffee. And he said, I just look up there and wink and say thanks. I sit at the table and I think, who would I bite today if I had rabies? And he said, I think, who would want to bite me if they had them? He said, I can't think of anybody. He said, you know, I feel good about that. You know, and so do I. So do I. But in 1974, I was sent by the chief executive officer of the L&N Railroad and asked to start an alcohol and drug abuse program on that railroad for him. He knew about me. We were friends. CEO, you know, and so asked me to come to his office. 1961, I was run off from there. Useless, shiftless, irresponsible, and undependable. Now I'm sitting in the president's office. He said, can it be done? I said, absolutely. He didn't know about you, but I did. He said, we travel in a lot of states. I said, that's okay. All we need is a little information. We'll get it. Don't worry about it. We'll put it together. He said, what do you want me to do? I said, nothing. Just let everybody in this company know I work for you, and they'll leave me alone. And they will. And they did. You know, they didn't like what I did or me either. I'd say, well, pick the phone up and call him. They don't. Nobody calls the CEO, you know. Yeah. Bless his heart, he's dead to a man named Prime Osborne. Somebody asked Mr. Osborne from a newspaper one time if trying to help alcoholics cost that company money. You know what his response was? He said, young man, I have no idea. He said, you know, inside of a corporation, money has a way of taking care of itself. But he said, let me ask you a question. How would you measure the value of a human life in dollars and cents? He said, I don't know how, and I don't try. We do what we can to help. You know, and so I start running all over the country, and that's when George quit drinking. He heard us coming. But it did a lot of good, and I stayed there till 1987, the end of 87. Our company was taken over by all through those mergers and crap, and they brought in people who were psychiatric social workers and all that kind of stuff. It's, you know, some of that thing is, it's interesting sometimes to have been around when there was nothing to work your butt off to get it started. To see it roll successfully into the fact that when you sit down with people, you know why alcoholics work so good with alcoholics? I don't want to tell you anything about you. I'm going to tell you about me. You know, people say all of this is AA oriented. It couldn't be. Nothing could be further from the truth. Not saying it don't do good, but how in the hell can you sit somebody down and say, I'm going to educate you about you when AA says, I'm going to tell you about me? It's a 360 degree opposite thing. And when all of the recovered alcoholics initially began to do that, the success was fantastic. God, we had great success on that railroad, as George can tell. And then it all came to an end, and that's okay, I guess. Time, you have to do what time does. Yeah. But that didn't bother me. I just retired. They gave me a year's salary, my company pension, and Gay and we just get around and do nothing now. I don't do nothing. I start doing that at noon. If you ever want a seminar on how to do nothing, call me. I'm an expert in that field. And all I do now is just hang around and try to help them kids. I love them kids. If you're young and NAA, I don't know of anything we think more of, you know. I get in trouble with them a whole lot, but that's okay. One of them's got me mad at God now. I ain't talking to God in heaven for a while. I'll owe you an explanation on that. He came in my house one day, and I was sitting in my lounge chair. I didn't let him in. About 20 years old, been sober 3 years, I think. Likes to hang around with this old fool. I don't know why. But he come in the house, and he said, "Where's Jack?" And my wife said, "In there, in that lounge chair." She said, "You know, I believe when he dies, I'll bury him standing up. I think change of positions would help." And that young boy looked at her and said, "Well, why don't you bury him face down so you can see where he's going?" And I said, "What in the hell are you doing in my house, boy? I didn't ask you in my damn house. I don't know what you're doing in here. Who in the hell sent for you?" You know, and he looked at me and he said, "According to the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, God sent me to you." I ain't spoke to God since. Live in total fear. He has another one. We have a great life. A great, great life. And it's nice being retired because you can come on Thursday to be an unofficial speaker and get to come a day early. Hey, I'm telling you, man, it's nice to be retired when some of these people put on these things. They like to have early bird meetings, you know. They had a conference here a while back at Daytona Beach, Florida, right on the ocean. And the guy said, "We're thinking very seriously of putting on a Wednesday night meeting. The conference officially opens Thursday." He said, "Can you come on Wednesday?" I said, "I can come on Monday." And he said, "Well, why don't you do that?" And I said, "I will, you know." So it's great to be retired. It's great to belong to AA. It's great to go to 5 AA meetings a week. It's great to get to know you. It's great to be in Callaway Gardens, you know. All the dimensions of my life are great, and I'm sure she'd tell you the same thing. It's beautiful. Hang in there. It'll be the same way for you. Thank you all for having me here.
Jack, that was a great story. I enjoyed it immensely. I didn't even get fidgety in my seat, and I can tell you work for a railroad. Okay.
I hope you're not fixing to do that, because we're...
No, I'm thinking the speaker right now, and then I'm going to call you up here. Thank you. Joe, you can have it. Should have left him alone, shouldn't I?
Damn. The only good part about speaking is getting introduced and getting thanked. I don't know why, but Jim and Tim have a presentation they want to make to Jack. And they want to give him a gift. And I can't imagine why Tim would want to give him a gift after you called him a psychiatrist. And I don't know where they are. Is that what they do? Yeah, we're ready. Is that what it is?
Thank you.
You don't need to worry about going home. We're going to raffle off your airline ticket.
Let's close. George, thank you so much. Jack, thank you. Let's close this meeting in the usual manner with the Lord's Prayer.